Thank you, Ruth. Good morning, great men and women of God. Hey, pop quiz. What were the two songs that you heard Ruth blend together just now? Yesu, Joy of Man's Desiring and Silent Night. Now, Silent Night we know is Christmas, but Yesu, Man of Joy, Yesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, normally we hear that when? Where have you ever heard that before? At weddings. You hear that a lot? What does it usually mean when that song starts to play? Here she comes, right? It's the bride. It's the arrival. It's so beautiful. As we were talking earlier, I said, Ruth, what are you going to play? I'm so excited. She said, I'm going to play these two songs. And she goes, but that one's kind of a wedding song. But as you think about that song, think about all about the arrival and the anticipation. When you hear that song, you want to stand up and turn around and look. Is she here? Is she coming? This is what we celebrate at Christmas, is the advent, the arrival, the expectation, but also the waiting. Second question this morning, how would you rate your ability to wait? Somebody in the first service said, on a scale of 1 to 10, I don't know, how would you rate that? Margaret Thatcher, the former Prime Minister of England, once said, I'm extraordinarily patient, provided I get my own way in the end. That made sense, right? I like that too. It is easy to be patient until you have to wait. And it seems like Christmas, almost more than any other season, is a season of waiting. You're waiting in line. You're waiting for packages. You're waiting for in-laws to arrive. You're waiting for in-laws to leave. You're counting the days until Jesus comes, right? What about waiting in the parking lots? Oh my goodness. You're waiting for a car to pull out. Do you know they did a study that drivers take longer to pull out of a space if someone is waiting on them? This is science, so listen up. If no one's waiting for the space, the time it took for someone to unlock their door and then pull out of the spot was 32.2 seconds. If someone's waiting, drivers take 39 seconds. What do you think happens if the waiting driver honks? 43 seconds. If you honk at me, I will demonstrate to you the power of waiting. I will sit there all day. I have nothing else to do but wait for you to stop honking. One of the reasons we want our Christmas offering to go towards this education for a lifetime, why we want to be in every single school in D11, is because as we're talking about issues of being teenagers and sexuality and choices and relationships, it's because it all comes down to this statement that waiting is difficult. What are you waiting on this Christmas? Something to happen? Someone to change? What are you waiting on? And what happens when your waiting turns into days, and then it maybe turns into weeks, and maybe it even turns into years? What happens when you get stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it? One author said this, and I thought, I don't know if this is true. This is something challenging. Second only to suffering, waiting may be the greatest teacher and trainer in godliness, maturity, and genuine spirituality most of us ever encounter. Do any of you think that could be true? Have you seen that be true? See, Advent's a season of waiting. We enter the past waiting of God's people as they waited for the arrival of Christ. And even now, we are God's people waiting for the arrival of Christ. And in this waiting, we find hope. This morning, in a letter written by James, the brother of Jesus, God is going to give us some Advent advice about the power of waiting well and the purpose of waiting. I'd love for you to turn with me to James chapter 5. Again, this is a letter written by James, who grew up as the brother of Jesus. He knew a lot about patience. How many of you have a brother? What would it take for you to become convinced that your brother is indeed God? Patience. Do you think Mary ever said, James, why can't you be more like your brother? James is like, seriously? He's Jesus. In this letter that James is writing, he's writing to other people that have come to the same conclusion he did, that this man, Jesus, was not just his brother, that he was just not somebody he grew up with, but in fact, he was the Messiah that they'd been waiting for centuries in their family and then in their faith. And not only was he this Messiah that they had waited for centuries, but James had come to believe that my brother died. I saw him die, and then my brother came back to life because he was more than my brother. He was my God. Can you imagine what it takes to come to that belief? And he's writing to these other people that also had come to this belief, this growing band of people who were convinced that this Jesus Christ was alive and resurrected. But this belief came at a high cost. It came at the cost of ridicule and persecution and oppression. Some of the people that James was writing to had experienced families being torn apart, had experienced losing their jobs, had some of them had experienced losing their lives, their property being seized, all because they believed in this thing called Christ. So imagine what they're waiting for. When will things change? And while they waited, they started to struggle with waiting like we do. They began to turn on each other, snipe at each other. They began to try to renegotiate this agreement with God. God, if we knew you would take so long, we might have waited and done some different things. And so these people were in need of some encouragement. And to these weary waiting believers, James writes in chapter 5, verse 7, be patient, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Be patient. When my daughter was little, she had a friend down the street she used to play with all the time. And one day her friend told her, yeah, I think we're moving away. And Clara was so sad. And a friend said, well, my parents haven't decided yet, so don't get your hopes down. James is saying, don't get your hopes down. Be patient and establish your hearts. And he gives us this metaphor. He says, you know, this kind of waiting on God, this waiting for his arrival, is kind of like being a farmer. Farmers plant. They water, they do everything they can, and then they have to what? Wait. They can't rush the freshest fruit of the earth. They can't control when the early and the late rains will arrive. They just have to establish their hearts and trust that the harvest is coming. I love this command, establish your hearts. I was reading through some different translations of how people have interpreted these original words, and one really caught my eye, and it was this: put iron in your heart. Put iron in your heart. What puts iron in the heart of a farmer? Why can they wait knowing that the harvest is coming? What does James says put? What does he say puts iron in the heart of a believer? Knowing that the Lord is coming. Now we understand here that James is talking about this second arrival of Christ. Just as he had come to believe that Christ had arrived the first time in the person of his brother, he also believed that Christ was going to return again one day. And when Christ returned, there would be no more waiting. Christ would show up and say, no more waiting, here I am. And when you hold to that, it puts iron in your heart. But I think in another sense that James is talking about not just this future arrival of Christ, but the everyday arriving of God. And a more general principle is this: be patient, because God is arriving. That God is available and desires to step into your life and your situation now, and to your pain and to your problem now, and to the thing that you're waiting for now. And he says, I am willing, I'm just around the corner, and I want to step in, and I want to be present with you, and I want to care for you. The problem is that when God arrives, he doesn't arrive the way that we expect. This was the biggest hurdle that James and a lot of other people like him had the first time that Christ arrived, because the Messiah didn't arrive the way they thought. The Messiah didn't look the way he thought that they thought he would look. No one expected the king to come as a baby. The Messiah didn't act the way that people thought he should act. No one expected him to welcome the unwelcomed. The Messiah didn't even do the things that they thought he should do. No one thought that this kingdom would end on a cross. But they were all missing the point. See, they were waiting for it, but what they got was him. They were waiting for it, but what they got was him. They were waiting for some circumstance to change. When will this change? When will this change? When will this change? And then Jesus shows up and says, I'm about to change everything. And what puts iron in our hearts is not that Jesus is going to show up and change the thing we want him to change. What puts iron in our hearts is that when God shows up, it's God himself. That God himself cares enough to step into our situations and arrive. That he'll be with us in our waiting. Now the problem we have is, just like the farmer, we look at the soil and nothing's happening. Day after day, we're looking at the dirt, nothing's moving, nothing's changing, it's the same. Yet we know, right? Below the surface, roots are growing, and shoots are moving, and seed is stirring. And for these first followers whose families had waited, and their faith families had waited for centuries for the Messiah to come, it was easy to begin to assume, you know, he's not coming. Imagine being a little Jewish kid back then before the arrival of Christ, and you're going to these different ceremonies, you're reading these different passages, and you're going to the synagogue, you're listening to somebody talk about one day the Messiah is going to come, and you're like, yeah, right, when? Dad, did you grow up hearing this? Yeah, I grew up waiting for the Messiah. Oh, what about Grandpa? Yeah, Grandpa grew up waiting. Well, what about Great-Grandpa? Yeah, Great-Grandpa. Well, what about Great-Great-Grandpa? Well, yeah, he grew up waiting too. You mean we're still waiting? It's been hundreds of years. When is this going to happen? Is this even true? And then all of a sudden, here he comes. Behind the scenes, God was arriving. And this is something powerful I think we take at Advent. It's this. Advent reminds us that while we wait, God arrives. While we wait, say it with me, God arrives. Be patient. Don't get your hopes down. Put iron in your heart by waiting. Now, James is a realist. He's a very practical person, and he understands that it's one thing to say, wait, and it's another thing to actually do it. And sometimes we're really challenged in our waiting. What does it look like when we're not waiting well? What does it look like when we're struggling to this? Well, he goes on in verse 9 and says, sometimes when we don't wait, this is what happens. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. When we get tired of waiting, we start to grumble. And what's interesting about this grumbling that we do is that we're not just grumbling in general. Oh, the government. Oh, this circumstance. Oh, the rain. But we actually begin to turn our grumbling towards the people that are closest to us. Isn't that interesting? Have you ever experienced that? Why is it that we turn towards one another, our brothers? One thing I've learned about grumbling is the issue is often not the issue. I've had a bad day at work, and I'm frustrated, and I can't take it out on anybody, and I walk in the door, and here's a bunch of people willing to listen to me grumble, and I take it out on them. I'm not mad at them. I'm mad at this, but they're there. You ever experienced that? We're stressed by something out there, a job, a situation, maybe even God himself, but we take it out on people in here, the ones closest to us. James says, when you're under pressure, don't turn on one another, brothers. And then he says, why not? Well, why won't we do that? Why shouldn't we grumble when we're waiting? So that you may not be judged. And I was trying to understand, why is there a connection here? Why did he go from grumbling to judging? And then I realized grumbling is a form of judging. When I grumble against you, and when I grumble against those closest to me, whether they're the people I work with, or people that I pray with, or people that I live with, people that I sleep with, when I grumble against them, it's because I'm judging the fact that they didn't understand me like I wanted, that they didn't help me like I wanted, that they didn't do what I wanted. And you know what? No. But we're not the judge, James says. Behold, the judge, he's standing right outside the door. Now, in a big sense, he's standing out the door in a way to come back, and he's going to come back in a big arrival, and we're waiting for that. But in another sense, he's always right behind the door. Always waiting to step in, and he's a much better judge than we are, so don't judge that you may not be judged. Let him carry that mantle. Don't take on that job. Let me ask you this. Is there anyone in your circle that you're grumbling against this season? You're facing some pressure, legitimate, real pressure, and the impatience is pouring out on somebody close to you, and you're realizing that this morning, and you're going, oh, that's not right. They're there to be your brothers. We also struggle when we're struggling with being patient, putting iron in our hearts, we turn impatience into something else. Look what he says in verse 12. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, let your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Now, this is actually not a passage about cursing. It's a passage about bargaining. Don't make deals. Don't make promises with God. When we've been waiting for a while, we start to go, okay, I'm tired of waiting. I got to get something moving. God, I'll make a deal with you. If you will do this, I will do this. I promise it. I swear to it. Is there any time that people bargain more than at Christmas? At Christmas, every child becomes a little litigator. And they begin to lay out this case before you with PowerPoint and overheads and handouts on why they should get this toy. Oh, I promise if I get the puppy, I will feed that puppy every day. And I will pick up after the puppy every day. Oh, if we had this toy, I promise, you'll never see it on the floor. Oh, if I had that shirt, that sweater, I would take such good care of it. Oh, mom and dad, you know what? We'll never fight. So we got an Xbox one year predicated on a promise that we were told that the group of our kids came together and they said, Father, Mother, we promise if we get a new Xbox that the kingdom will come in promise and in fullness. We will never fight. We'll come up with a schedule on who gets to play it when. We won't have any more arguments. We will be such a time of fellowship and joy. It'll be like Acts chapter 2 around the Xbox. It was the Acts chapter 2 thing that got me. Well, that's scripture. We unwrap the Xbox. You want to guess how many seconds it took for the first fight to begin? 43 seconds. Yay, Dad, thanks, I'm going to play it. No, I'm going to play it. And we were off to the races. Why? We made promises under pressure and bargains under pressure, but when the time came to pay due, it couldn't happen. Now listen, God is not opposed to our promises. I stood right here yesterday afternoon as a man and a woman pledged and promised their lives together before God. God is not opposed to you making promises to him. James is cautioning us. Be careful with promises made in impatience. Because bargaining, here's what it really is. Bargaining is an attempt to get out of the situation. I don't like the situation I'm in. God, what deal can I make with you to get out of it? But if you remember, think back, James is writing to a bunch of people who are facing incredible tough situations of persecution and oppression because of their faith. And James is not writing with a plan of, here's how you get out of it. How to get out of that persecution was very simple. Hey, I renounce Jesus Christ. I don't believe him anymore. Yeah, I was crazy. I don't think he rose from the dead. All the pressure would be off of them. They'd be welcomed back into society with open arms. It was easy. James could have said, let me just write you a 3-sentence letter. Just renounce everything and all the pressure will be off. But he didn't do that. He didn't tell them how to get out of the situation. The whole point of James' letter was not to get out of trials, but how to go through them. Consider all joy, my brothers, when you go through trials. The whole point of James is how to put iron in your hearts while you're under pressure. And bargaining may leave you in a situation where you're not able to keep up your end. So let me ask you this as you're thinking, this season. You may be in a real tough situation. Are you bargaining or waiting with God? Now, what I love about James is, again, he's a very practical guy. He knows that this waiting is difficult. It is so easy. Is it the easiest thing in the world to say, be patient, but it's another to do it. And this is why when we grumble and why we are tending to bargain, we can turn to something. We can turn to a place to put iron in our hearts. Who can help us? Now, you'd think the answer would be Jesus, and you normally would be right, but it's really interesting. I don't know if it's because he grew up with him or not, but James is like, I'm not going to say Jesus. I'm going to give you a different answer. One way that you put iron in your hearts is verse 10. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets. Take those people of old who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. James says, if you want help learning how to be patient, look to the examples of people who waited well. Find a model of patience to put iron in your hearts. Find people who didn't let their hopes get down. Now, what James offers us is he says, think about the prophets, for example. Imagine the patience of a prophet. You are a prophet in the Old Testament. Your job is to tell people this is what God has said. And often God would come and tell you things and you would have to wait on him and no one else heard. No one else heard, just that person. And the promise was, listen, God's going to do this. And the people are going, when? When? You've been saying this for 20 years. When? And the prophets had to remain blessed, remain steadfast. And when they did, they saw these promises come true. Imagine the prophets that died telling people, oh no, I promise Messiah's coming, he's coming, he's coming, he's coming. Dead. 2 centuries later, here he comes. What kind of patience is required? And yet you hear their stories and it puts iron in your heart. Who's the example of patience in your life? Maybe it's a family member who's endured something. Maybe it's a friend that you know that has faced long suffering. Maybe it's someone you've never even met, but they're a hero to you. Who puts iron in your heart? You know, this is not just a rhetorical question. I would actually like to know this. Some of you are watching online, and I want you to think about this question and come up with your name. But some of us here in this room, I actually would love to hear right now, who is an example of patience that you look to and you say, when I think about them, it puts iron in my heart. Right? Who is that? Who is it? Anyone have one? Who? Your mother. Okay. An example of patience. Who else? Great. Let me see you so I can see you. Yeah. Your wife. You're so wise on many levels, Jerry. I appreciate that. Examples, men. That's right there. But I know you believe that. That's right. She's put up with knuckleheads like us. That's right. Who's an example that puts iron in your heart? Yeah. Your sister-in-law. Why does your sister-in-law put iron in your heart? What's her patience? Sister-in-law is like a sister because of her patience and her friendship. Who else do you look to? Anyone? Yeah, John? Grandmother. Why? She's 99 and she's patiently waiting for the Lord to take her home. Okay. Someone in an earlier service said, Corrie ten Boom. And I know they didn't meet her, but they know her story. James is saying, look, there are people out there who've done it. And sometimes just what you need to hear is that it's possible. And sometimes you're waiting on something and you're like, no one has ever waited like I have waited before. And that is a lie. That's not true. And what God is saying is, no, 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 open your heart up. There are people who've waited. And when you look to them and you listen to them, you realize it is possible with God and it puts iron in your heart. When I think about the people that put iron in my heart, a lot of them come from the Bible. One of my personal heroes is Moses. I love Moses because he was a man of great impatience, and yet God taught him and used him. Think about the people in the Bible who waited well. Hosea waited on a spouse who was a serial cheater. He remained steadfast, and he saw God arrive in great love. Daniel waited to be executed. He waited in patience, steadfast, and saw God deliver. Noah, one of these prophets that James is talking about, he waited through mockery. He remained steadfast, and he saw God arrive with a drop of rain. Joseph was sold into slavery by his own brothers and waited for years in prison, unfairly arrested. He remained steadfast, and he saw God open doors he could have never imagined. Or Rahab, this prostitute who was waiting for a better life, was waiting for some kind of purpose or meaning. She remained steadfast. She saw God arrive and use her as part of his plan to rescue an entire planet. All these people, in a sense, may have been waiting for it, but they found him. They were waiting for this to change, but when God arrived, it was God himself that they saw. So here's the thought. When you wait well, you can see God arrive. When you wait well, you can see God arrive. Let me give an example of this, and then I want us to pray. There's a friend of ours, Jessica and I, that is facing her first Christmas without her husband. Because earlier this year, he left her for another woman. Every moment of these holidays that she'd been looking forward to now have taken on a dark twist. Every ornament that they purchased together, she's now wondering, do I hang this on the tree or not? Every Christmas movie they had built in year after year to watch together as part of their rituals now is something that she doesn't even want. What is she waiting for? She could be waiting for her husband to change. She could be waiting for it to happen. But honestly, he might change. He might not change. If she's waiting for that to be the thing that she's waiting for and it doesn't happen, how does that put iron in her heart? Listen to some words that she posted online this last week. She said, "Today I finally listened to my first Christmas song, O Come All Ye Faithful. As I listened to it, the tears just streamed down my face. He is the reason we celebrate Christmas. It's not the presents and the tree and the Christmas cards we get in the mail. These are all good things, but I am reluctantly entering into this Christmas season. I have to remember that He is faithful. He is good. He will see me through one of the most difficult times in my life. For that, I am thankful." Here's a woman who has wrestled with grumbling. She has wrestled with bargaining, but she is waiting for something more than it to change and arrive. She's waiting for God to arrive. She's waiting for God. She's leaning on Him. She's not waiting for it. She's waiting for Him. God, show up and bring yourself to me this Christmas. See, Advent reminds us that God is just around the corner. He's right outside the door. He's just below the soil. He's working behind the scenes. He is arriving. So be patient. Don't grumble. Don't bargain. Put iron in your heart and wait for Him to arrive. Now, one day we believe that He will arrive in a very powerful way. And when He arrives, all the it we've been asking for is coming with Him. Fix this, fix that. Jesus says, I'm working on it, and I will do it all when I arrive. But until that arrival, He arrives every day in the hearts of waiting people. So what does it look like this season for you to shift your waiting from it to Him? Not that this necessarily will change, but that He will arrive. And when He does what He will do better than anyone else. I think captured so well by Ann Voskamp when she writes this. Jesus, with His pierced side, is always on the side of the broken. Jesus always moves in places moved with grief. Jesus always seeks out where the suffering is, and that's where Jesus stays. The wound in His side proves that Jesus is always on the side of the suffering, the wounded, the busted, the broken. And I would just add this, Jesus is always on the side of the waiting. Let's wait on God together through prayer. Will you join me? God, if You would just hurry up, we wouldn't have to wait. You are so slow according to our timetables. Give us the vision to see that beneath the soil behind the scenes, You are arriving. Pray for this woman that we spoke of, that Lord, You are arriving in a powerful way and meeting her and surrounding her and speaking to her as only you can on the side of the suffering. And this Christmas, as all of us wrestle with our own versions of waiting, may our waiting shift from it to who? Thank you for allowing us to serve a God who waits with us. Amen.